Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival in its third fantastic year. I've known Sherilyn Parsons for years, and she founded this festival. I founded the one in L.A., and she worked on that one. She volunteered even this year when she was so busy putting this festival on to volunteer at the L.A. Festival. So anyway, I think it's a great thing for Berkeley and the Bay Area. Go ahead. First, I want to tell everyone to please silence your cell phones. You probably know that already, but... And then also, I'm going to introduce myself and the other speakers, and then we'll start with our program. I'm Narda Zucchino. I am right now an executive editor of Heyday Books. It's a rather new position under Steve Washman, who also was pretty new in that job. And before that, I had a lifelong career at the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, mostly the LA Times. And I also edit books, so I'm a book person. And this is my book that came out last August, California Comeback, How a Failed State Became a Model for the Nation, which is more relevant today than it was when I published it, because it's California Fight Back time. I have to get my notes. We have with us today, the title of our panel is Gentrification, Evictions, and the State of Our Cities. I just want to say, last week, Peter Moskowitz, who wrote this book, How to Kill a City, did a book appearance in Los Angeles at a place called The Last Bookstore, which is a very large bookstore in downtown L.A. It's really a cool place. And I went to it because I knew I was going to be doing this panel. And we couldn't get in. I mean, it was so crowded. My husband had to wait in line. My friend and I had to sit on the floor. Thank you very much. And we got there in plenty of time, but there were over 300 people crammed into this little bookstore, including in between the aisles, all over the floor, on the second floor, hanging over the railings. And I think we were, my husband and I and our friend, kind of raised the age average just a little bit, but I would say 99% of the people there were in their 20s or something. This crowd's a little bit older, but the subject resonates with so many people and so many young people, especially in a place like downtown Los Angeles. But I'm really happy to have these two authors today and to be part of this panel, because like I said, it is a really important subject. First, I'm going to introduce Paul Madonna. He's an award-winning artist and writer. This is his book, On to the Next Dream. He's the creator of a series, All Over Coffee, which captivated readers of the San Francisco Chronicle for 12 years, in which he captured the character of the city. I don't know if you guys know that feature, but it was very popular. He's also the author of 4 books, his most recent being this one that we're going to discuss today. He told me he's also writing a novel. It's coming out when?
September.
Yeah, so we have that to look forward to. Paul's drawings and stories have appeared internationally in numerous books and journals, as well as in galleries and museums, including an upcoming exhibit, a solo exhibition at the Legion of Honor in San Francisco, and that's going to be in June of 2018. So I think that's pretty amazing. Paul has a bachelor's degree in fine arts from Carnegie Mellon University, and his new book that we're discussing today really describes in stark language and images his personal experiences with gentrification in San Francisco. How many of you are from San Francisco here today? The rest of you from the East Bay, I guess? Okay. And some from nowhere. The San Francisco Chronicle said, On to the Next Dream describes the emotional journey in search of a new home and studio. Wait a second. I wanted to get the actual real books instead of the copies I was given. So this is Paul's, and this is Peter's. I think my name should be Mary, right? Peter, Paul. Peter, Paul, and Mary. I'm sorry. Let me go back to what I was saying. The Chronicle describes his book, his journey of in searching for a new home and a studio, during which he, quote, rubbed shoulders with immigrants, vegans, and real estate agents. What holds his journeys together is a tragicomic sense of the absurd. And I know you'll like that book. Peter Moskowitz is a freelance journalist who's written for The Guardian, The New York Times, The New Republic, Wired, Slate, BuzzFeed. See, this is all over the map from The New York Times to BuzzFeed. I won't ask you which paid you more, but... and many others. A former staff writer for Al Jazeera America, he's a graduate of Hampshire College and the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He lives in Philadelphia, having moved there from New York City. His new book, Goodreads, calls a, quote, vigorous, hard-hitting expose that reveals who holds power in our cities and how we get it back. He explores and exposes causes and often heartbreaking ramifications of gentrification, digging deep into the subject that's captured the imaginations, for good or bad, of big city officials, property developers, hipsters, artists, urban dwellers, of which I am one. I'll get into that in a minute. The nation's media, and more. He focuses on four cities, New Orleans, San Francisco, New York, and Detroit. And I told him this morning that his book was very depressing to read. not that you shouldn't read it, because I learned so much from his book. The New Orleans story was just jaw-dropping. I mean, I didn't know a lot of what's in that story because the media didn't cover it, and maybe you can get into that, but as well as it should have. But I want to start with Paul, whose book also was depressing, but it was a different book altogether. I sort of say gentrification is defined quite simply by Wikipedia as the displacement and replacement of the poor for profit, which is exactly what it is, only it's a whole lot more. And I think as you will find in this, what we're going to discuss today, that gentrification has winners and losers and has good parts and bad parts, and it's a complicated, complex situation, but that's a very simple. Gentrification is the displacement and replacement of the poor for profit. I'm going to start with Paul, because Paul told me that his book is not just about gentrification or eviction, but it's about a creative response to the situation. So tell us what you mean by that.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me all right? Yeah? No? How did you know what I said then? I think it's great to be on the panel with Peter, because we're basically addressing the same situation from two really different points of view. My wife and I were evicted from our home in the Mission District in San Francisco, and
Mike's,
is the mic not on? Oh, well then I was doing all right on my own, wasn't I?
Oh, maybe the volume has to
Can
be
somebody,
turned up.
Can somebody address the board? Maybe turn that up for me, please.
Oh, that's now you can.
Yeah, better.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm just going to hold it. My wife and I were evicted 2 years ago from our home in the Mission District in San Francisco, and what I did is I decided to write a fictional story about that experience, and really what it was is a way to process. Thank you. A way to process the experience through art and deliver it to an audience. You know, the metaphor that I use is, you know, if you're going through something really extreme, you have to find a way to express it. Imagine you're out on the streets and there's somebody up on top of a building and they're screaming and they're tearing off their clothes and they're going out of their mind about how crazy this something is, and you from down below you don't necessarily have sympathy. You look up and you say, you know, there's something wrong with that person, and that's essentially what was happening to us. And I wanted to make something that, rather than look like screaming on the page, transferred all that energy into a story so that the reader could look at it and say, wow, this is a crazy situation. So I chose the satirical form, very absurdist. So each chapter begins in a seemingly normal situation and then gets to an outrageous point.
Okay. Peter, can you tell us, give us a little better definition of gentrification that you go into in great detail in your book, and maybe the phases of it?
Sure. So I think gentrification doesn't necessarily have a precise definition, and I'm okay with that. I like how people have started to use the word in a lot of different contexts, you know, gentrification of hip hop or, you know, just different ways to describe different phenomena. But my book is specifically looking at housing, and when you're talking about housing, I think gentrification is essentially always a top-down process where developers and city officials collude to replace the poor for profit. And so it's a purposeful displacement. And even in cities where there's plenty of space to develop, such as Detroit, displacement still happens because gentrification is essentially an economic mechanism to reprioritize a city for the rich and deprioritize it for the poor. So that's what I wanted to look into in each city. I chose the four cities. I chose New Orleans, Detroit, San Francisco, and New York because to me they kind of represented what researchers have been calling like the four phases of gentrification all the way back since the 1970s. The first phase being kind of like the organic kind of gentrification where artists and hipsters and that kind of crowd are moving in. The second phase being when the kind of yuppie crowd moves in, and then the third and fourth phases being the more top-down versions of gentrification in which it's really all about developers and banks and city governments doing it, and individuals, unless they're millionaires, don't really have the buying power to influence a city at that point. Although I'd argue at this point, almost every instance of gentrification is now within that third and fourth phase, even in cheaper cities. Than San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley, it's almost always initiated by players with power and not by individuals these days.
Yeah. So I found your, when I told you guys you should read this book, because you'll learn a lot of things you didn't know before, the story of New Orleans is just heartbreaking. And I think I want you to talk a little bit about that and what happened to the schools and also what happens in public housing throughout all of your cities. But I wanted you to talk about the factor that race plays in all of this, because hundreds of thousands of people, poor people, have been displaced, and the majority of them are black or Latino, but not white people. And they're poor. So how does that, I mean, tell the story of New Orleans.
Sure. I'll start with New Orleans and then I'll kind of work backwards in time a little bit.
Sure.
So I start the book in New Orleans because gentrification is so obvious there, and the way in which it was implemented is so obvious. And that, I think, gives readers a good backing to go into these cities where it's a little more subtle. But essentially, in 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit and knocked down levees that should have been built better, almost the entire city was evacuated. And politicians there used the storm as an opportunity to essentially shut out black residents from coming back and to replace them with new white residents. This, it would sound like a conspiracy, but like it's really well documented. The words they said were essentially, don't come back here.
Yeah.
Governor Kathleen Blanco at the time said it took the storm of a lifetime to create the opportunity of a lifetime. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, literally wrote an article saying, we can't have the same people coming back to New Orleans or else we'll have a poor city again, so why would we allow them back? And they implemented policy that essentially got them there. So the entire school system was disbanded and turned into an all-charter school system.
Can you repeat that? Because I don't think people quite grasp that. Imagine Oakland, let's say, just totally disbanding all the public schools and turning them all into charter schools, or San Francisco.
So basically what the governor took, basically created a law that said any school that fails this certain metric can be taken over by the state, and coincidentally, only schools in New Orleans failed this like very specific metric. And so all of them except for four, which happened to pass the metric, were shut down and reopened as charter schools. The entire teachers union, which was mostly made up of black middle class women usually, or mostly, was also, they were all fired. Everyone had to reapply for their jobs in new non-unionized schools. So that bastion of the black middle class of New Orleans was essentially destroyed overnight. They shut down every unit of public housing in the city, even though few of them were damaged by the storm, and replaced them with private mixed income housing, which houses about a third as many people as it does, houses as a third as many people today as it did before the storm. And they also, there were also more subtle things, which, you know, you can argue about the intent, but, you know, FEMA wouldn't give people enough money to rebuild their houses. They would give them one-way plane tickets to places like Utah and Alaska and New York. And people, you know, they literally were evacuated out of the city. They had no money. New Orleans is a poor city, so a lot of people who ended up in these far-flung places would just stay there. I tell the story of one guy who came back after literally like swimming out of New Orleans to try to rebuild his house, which is in Treme, which is a gentrifying neighborhood in the city. He was told by the National Guard that they'd kill him if he kept coming back. When he persisted, he finally was able to stay, rebuilt his house by hand, but FEMA never gave him enough money to actually rebuild it. And so he ended up having to sell it and to a wealthier couple.
But explain that they declared it blighted, right? They declared it, if I recall that particular story. And wasn't that his grandmother's house that she owned it in the first place?
Right, yeah.
And I think you wrote that they declared a lot of these homes as a blight, which right. gave them, after 30 days, the right
well,
to...
Well, yeah, so what would happen is essentially FEMA, and there was a lawsuit that was eventually won, but it didn't really do anything, that showed that FEMA was giving black residents of New Orleans less money to rebuild their houses than white residents. Mm-hmm. So they essentially, let's say, you'd get $50,000 to rebuild a $200,000 house. You can't do anything with that except move. And so that ended up giving the city of New Orleans a lot of vacant properties, which it took over. They would declare them blighted. Like, let's say you can't fix your home, so the grass starts growing in front of it. The city will declare it blighted after 30 days, start charging you fines until you go into foreclosure, and then the city owns your property and then sells it to a developer. My book is depressing, sorry. Just to go back a little bit to the question about race, I mean, obviously it was, you know, as I said, very obvious in New Orleans, but the whole history of housing in the U.S. is racially motivated, you know, from the creation of the suburbs after the Great Depression, when the government created these mortgage instruments that were essentially only available to white people. You know, if you've heard the term redlining, literally the federal government drew red lines around entire cities and based those based where they would lend money on how many black people existed within those areas. So essentially the government gifted a whole generation of white people housing wealth via the creation of the suburbs. And now you're seeing those same people who are gifted that housing wealth coming back to the city, and they have so much greater purchasing power because of that decision almost 100 years ago. So I think that's how gentrification often operates. Everywhere, you don't need a storm, you don't need, even a debt crisis. San Francisco, for example, wasn't in the dire situation that New York was in when it started to gentrify, but because of all these factors that go back hundreds of years, literally, that it's kind of an inevitability in how it operates in every single city, regardless of the specific circumstances of the city.
Somebody was telling me the other day, they were from Detroit, that, oh, Detroit's doing really great now. You know, it's gentrifying, and it's a really great city. And I know you don't paint such a rosy picture about Detroit in your book.
Yeah. I like to think about it like the way highways were rammed through neighborhoods in every city. The way that they decided to put a highway through a certain neighborhood was whether that neighborhood made the city money, essentially. If it was a tax burden on the city, it got a highway rammed through it, because what that did is scatter all the people who needed things like welfare and public schools. And so that was back in the 40s and 50s. Gentrification can be thought of as a similar kind of mechanism. Neighborhoods in Detroit that are making the city money, i.e. downtown Detroit, what developers call the 7.2, which is the 7.2 square miles in the core of Detroit. And for context, Detroit is something like 144 square miles, so a very small area, is getting all the money, all the tax breaks, all the new public transportation. And the rest of the city, until a few years ago, didn't have things like streetlights, garbage collection. A lot of people don't have running water. And the county refuses to lower taxes. They're still basing their property tax rates as if Detroit was a healthy city. So you could own a house that's literally worth $10,000 and be paying $10,000 a year in taxes. And so, like in New Orleans, that has the same effect of forcing people into foreclosure. The county takes over your property and then sells it to the highest bidder. And you can, if you really want to be depressed, go to Detroit to the Cobo Center, which is their big convention center, in January. And there's literally tens of thousands of people lined up to try to save their house from tax foreclosure. It's their big Save Your House from Tax Foreclosure Day that they have every year, and trying to work out plans with the city and county governments. Not coincidentally, almost everyone there is African American.
Yeah.
I did want to say, to your point about this idea of like the guy screaming on the top of the building, I think we have to think of gentrification as this trauma at all levels. It's a mental trauma when you are evicted. It's a trauma to a city. It's a trauma to the fabric of a city. And I think it even erases collective memory. Where I grew up in the West Village in New York, my parents were kind of some of the original gentrifiers, loft dwellers back in the 70s and 80s. When I walk through that neighborhood, what I see is different than what everyone else sees, right? Mm-hmm. When someone with their like little poodle in a Fendi bag or whatever is walking down 11th Street or Bleecker Street, they see a cute neighborhood that has good and expensive brunch. And what I see is like the destruction of where I grew up. What I see is where my friends used to live. What I see is the inability of my inability to form a community by planting roots because I can't afford to live there near my family. That idea of trauma to me is really, I think, the best way to frame how gentrification operates.
Well, I'd like to say to that, there's what I found interesting in your book is you paint a really wonderful illustration of how we're essentially all part of that system complicitly. Like, we don't mean to be, but I grew up in the suburbs, and you talk about how the suburbs were basically something that was sold to America, and in effect was part of another form of gentrification. And the generations that grew up there and were disgruntled with it for obvious reasons, because the suburbs didn't provide what we sort of humanly need for community, then started returning to the city. And I very much felt like that was my experience.
Right.
And I didn't understand that I was doing that. I just had an inclination to leave the suburbs and get to a place where I felt like I could interact with people and build something. And so, in effect, I was one of the artists that came in when the neighborhood was bad,
right.
And in effect contributed to the change that would ultimately happen. But I think it's interesting. I've been thinking about where crossovers are between our books, since we have these really different approaches to a similar subject. And for me, it's about the vision of a place, and I think you brought that up right now. Of when I came to San Francisco, I had an idea of what that place was historically, and what it would mean to me, and what I expected to have there. But what I didn't realize is that I was essentially affecting somebody else's vision, right, of the place. In the same way that people might be complaining right now, or my generation is complaining about who is getting off the bus. Let's say, just to use that as a metaphor. When I was getting off the bus, there were people probably saying, "You're the one ruining this,
right,
place." And that is essentially happening all of the time. And we're all sort of caught up in this systemic treadmill. And how do we change it? It's difficult to change it individually. And sort of that's where the, you know, you're telling the story about the man who literally swam away from New Orleans, came back, and was threatened to be shot to rebuild his own home.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a complete absurdity to that, and yet we hear these stories, and we just sort of nod our heads, and we're like, yeah, that sucks, and we're kind of used to hearing those stories. And as an example, in the first chapter that I had written that I published in the Chronicle that ultimately became this book, I begin it with, I'm at a cafe and I sort of get run out of a cafe and I come home to find an eviction notice on my door. So I go next door to my neighbor's that is up for sale and they're bidding on the place. And I realize that they're not actually bidding on the place, but they're bidding on a cardboard box in the corner that somebody jumps into and screams, I'm going to pay $1 million for this box. Oh. And I thought it was this sort of absurd, clever metaphor. And I ran it, and I'm not exaggerating that I got emails saying, did this really happen?
Yeah.
And it's that sort of absurdity of like, what is the reality has become such that even fiction can't rival it. Like, I had to turn the amp up on fiction in order to compete with reality.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw a story about a developer in the Mission painting over a Dia de los Muertos mural because it was too dark, and then the mural he wrote to replace it says "Be nice" on it. So, like, just like if you wrote that in your book, it would have been like corny or like
right.
Unbelievable.
It would have been, right, exactly.
You know, Paul, you talk about Peter painting these beautiful illustrations of what. And I just want to say, you're a great artist. And this book is worth buying, if only for the illustrations, but it also for the story. But your work is so beautiful. And I want to ask you, you know, artists are really they play a huge role in gentrification in many ways. I mean, they're gentrified out of their places, like you were, but they also are used as pawns, in a way, as magnets, to draw you know, young people, hipsters, and everything to a neighborhood. I want to give you this example that it also. This is a story that also it took place in February, but there was an art gallery in Boyle Heights, which is a section of Los Angeles. And then I will get to a question for you out of this. And this art gallery, Boyle Heights, is adjacent to Los Angeles. It's predominantly Latinos. In fact, my son and daughter-in-law live right on the borderline of Boyle Heights. And it's a changing neighborhood. And an art gallery, so a donor made a contribution of $2 million to buy this old warehouse, decrepit warehouse, and turn it into an art gallery and to restore it and have an art gallery there. And after it immediately started drawing protests from community activists who said that it was being used to gentrify the neighborhood. So this was going to be the beginning of gentrification, and they were really frightened about it. But the gallery was called PSST, which is how you spell P-S-S-S-T. It's how you say PSST. And they were careful to say it's not an acronym, but PSST. So that's the name of it. That was the name of it because it closed. It opened in, I think, late or mid-2016, and it closed in 2017. After a year, they had a 20-year lease on the building, but they couldn't take the harassment that they said they were getting from these protesters. Like, for example, they had an exhibit opening. And on opening night, the protesters showed up, and there was graffiti on the wall, and it said, "Fuck white art." Now, the police department thought that they started investigating it as a hate crime. I guess they thought it was against white artists, but I'm not sure that's true. But it was at first investigated as hate crime, but it was white. The definition of white art, and I had never seen this before, is it's called whitewashing, and it's whitewashing. Developers and speculators using the presence of artists to rebrand a neglected neighborhood to a desirable one. It's called whitewashing, and I hadn't heard that term before. So they said, you know, that they called it white art. In any case, the gallery founders there was an article about them in the New York Times because this was a new gallery, and they were catering to underrepresented artists, women, people of color, people who identified as LGBTQ, artists who challenged the existing structures within the arts. And one of the founders said, we find that diversity in art, in the art world here is not great in LA. if you're, or anywhere, I guess, if you're trying to have hard conversations, you're not going to have them if everyone's coming from the same place and agreeing with each other. So, you know, it sounds like they were really trying to do something. They were also giving studio space to struggling artists who couldn't afford studio space in Los Angeles. So, it seems to me this might be an example where, well, certainly, as I said, artists play a role. So in this case, I mean, in a lot of these situations, I think you might both agree, there are winners and there are losers. And, you know, these are people, I don't know anything about this gallery except what I read this morning. Maybe they were trying to help artists, and maybe they were just using it to gentrify the neighborhood, to make this developer rich. And Peter, but, I mean, yeah, you can answer Peter, but also, Paul, well, I'll, you go first, okay. And then I'll go to
Paul.
Well,
I just want to say that in our current system of privatized housing and development where land is a commodity, it doesn't matter what the intent is, and I would believe, I don't want to put words in these protesters' mouths, but I believe that was their point, was right. That it doesn't matter if you have good intentions, if what you do inevitably ends up helping gentrify a neighborhood. There was an activist who I interviewed for the book who lives in the Mission, Annabelle Bolaños, and she talked about how she, you know, she was like usually the first to volunteer to help plant trees on the like tree planting day, and you know, she was happy that they were like making upgrades to the neighborhood, whatever. And then she said, and then all of a sudden I felt like I was taking the smallpox blankets. And I thought that was like a really good way of putting it, of just, you know, what in this system, desirable features become real estate features. And, you know, to use the neighborhood I grew up in as an example again, that I grew up three or four blocks away from where Jane Jacobs wrote Death and Life of Great American Cities. She used my neighborhood as the example of how a neighborhood should be, you know, with its varied streets and its trees and its, you know, varied density of buildings and all those features that made it so desirable and diverse in the eyes of Jacobs are what allowed it to gentrify, to become essentially empty condominiums and $20 million brownstones owned by like Russian oil oligarchs. So obviously, you know, everyone loves a tree, everyone loves an art gallery, but when they become in the system, when they become features of real estate capitalism, I think people feel like they have no choice but to resist them.
Paul, isn't it true? I mean, you're an artist and you were evicted. And artists, I think artists are, you know, according, in addition to having a racial component, artists are people who are pretty much used to, in this situation, lose their houses, lose their housing. I wanted you to talk a little bit, and I wanted to know whether you see them as victims or you see them as pawns. And also, I want you to talk a little bit about your personal and how you went on this journey to find a new place, because your house that you were evicted from was also your studio, correct?
Yes, it was also my studio. You know, there's so many different points to touch on. One I want to say is that, in a way, the artists... Well, okay, first of all, I don't think anybody wants to be seen as a pawn or a victim, right? Uh-huh. And I certainly didn't want to see myself as that. And I found myself caught in a really odd point, because I'm essentially, you know, I'm a middle class white guy, right? So it was really difficult for me to sort of stick my head up and say, oh, this is, you know, I'm being evicted. I didn't want pity, but mm-hmm. to even discuss the topic, I felt like it wasn't necessarily my role. And I was also in a position that I was, you know, I'm doing well enough that I was able to find a new place and stay in San Francisco. So again, I wasn't playing the victim card in the sense of, oh, I'm the poverty. And I think there's, we could go somewhere else too and talk about the idea that gentrification, while it, you know, bulldozes over the poor, it affects others as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went right after it happened and I started publishing the series in the Chronicle. I started going to meetings, you know, group meetings about with people being evicted, and the thing that I came away with was, wow, I don't belong here, because so many of the people who I met were just insanely worse off than me.
Yeah.
You know, I basically, you know, I've created my own career. I created my own life. I felt like I had so many more options. And here I was in this difficult situation, and yet how could I help anybody except to just sort of tell the story in a way that wasn't about me? And that's why it you know, quickly went into fiction. I want to say, I know I'm jumping around, but there's so many points. I then moved to the Excelsior, which is still in San Francisco, but I feel like a gentrifier there. Mm-hmm. Because this is a neighborhood that's an old school neighborhood, lots of families that, you know, there's one house in that neighborhood that I've seen that's been torn down and rebuilt. And that to me is the very beginning sign that it's coming, but it's still really early on. And so here I am, I was forced out of the Mission. And then I go to a place where my neighbors look at me as, oh, you're the thing that's going to force us out.
Yeah.
So there's that caught in the middle. Again, that sort of systemic situation. I also want to say about art and artists is that there is also a contradiction, because in order for artists to be successful, we need an audience in which to sell our work to. And, you know, like it or not, it tends to be the wealthier class that support artists. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where your fellow artists don't have the money to buy your work, to pay your bills. So there is sort of this also middle ground of, the reason I'm able to do well enough to stay in San Francisco is a result of sort of the very gentrification that ultimately tried to push me out. And I think another point, wonderful point you make in your book, is that there is no individual blame, which is also part of the problem why we can't stop it. Mm-hmm. Because there's no individual, and it is part of the system. So, you know, I know I'm jumping around, but in each of those points, at the end of the day, I said, well, how do I address that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Go ahead.
I wouldn't go as far as to say there's no individual blame, because I do think we all have a role to play, and like, not to ask the question, what is art? But like, there are different forms of art, right? You can make art that's like a mural that is on the side of a new condo building that helps a developer gentrify a neighborhood, or you can make a piece of art that says "fuck developers." Like, this idea that there are artists and there are non-artists, to me, is kind of ridiculous. You know, like, the specifics matter. What intent you have in challenging the system matters. Yes, no one person can solve gentrification, but like, a collective art movement against it could help things, I think. A collective writers movement, a collective protest movement could help. I think people feel really paralyzed by gentrification because it's such a huge issue, but it kind of has the same answer as any issue does, mm-hmm. which is, you know, whether it's racism or anti-women's rights stuff or whatever, it's about collective organizing and collective action.
Yeah. I just want to say that I'm an urban dweller, and we actually, my husband and I, moved to downtown Los Angeles in 1978. So it was almost 40 years ago when there was nothing downtown. I mean, one of the issues about this that resonated with me was, you know, there was no, you couldn't buy a carton of milk or a loaf of bread unless you went to a local liquor store. And so there was no, we had to get in a car and drive far away to go to do grocery shopping. And there was very little. The parks had a lot of homeless people. And it was the city of Los Angeles has changed now 40 years later to amazingly gentrified in most of the streets downtown. There are still some where, and then you have somewhere you have problems with drugs and people shooting up right in front of you and stuff like that, and crazy people shouting in the middle of the night, and like you were talking about. But we're living in the same building. We actually moved away I got transferred by the LA Times up to Sacramento, and then to Orange County, and then back to LA. And we bought the same unit back that we had sold. So we bought it in 2000. And I mean, there's been this dramatic. For us, the quality of life is better. I don't know. It wasn't like moving out a lot of people, displacing a lot of people. It was rather, although it was for poorer people who lived in the SROs that are now condos. Wasn't tearing down buildings or anything. So it was gradual change. But for the people who live there, and now there's a downtown LA is full of residential, but a lot of it is young people. Like I was talking, that's why I think there was such a big turnout for Peter's panel, because a lot of these young people are tenants, and the rents are very high. But one of the things, one of the ramifications I want to talk about is the homeless situation. I mean, from we can go two blocks, and there are tents, you know, tent cities that go on all the sidewalks for block after block after block. It used to be confined to Skid Row, Los Angeles. Now it's creeping all over the city. In fact, when I started preparing for this panel, I was looking at a figure, and I can't remember the figure I used in my book, but in 2016, the homeless figure in Los Angeles, the count for Los Angeles County, and it's always an undercount because you can't count every homeless person, was 46,000 people. Now, last week on May 30th, the report came out. It's now 58,000 homeless people in Los Angeles County. It's 58,000 people. And I know there's a correlation to the gentrification, because where do people go? I mean, what happened in San Francisco, Paul? What happened to all the people who got, you know, when the rents went up 250%? Well, tell about your rent. What did your rent grow to?
Well, our rent doubled, and I'm also in the process of looking for a new studio, which will actually make my rent go up even higher in terms of just my outlet, my monthly output. Where do the people go in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Tents as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the toleration for the building of tent cities, and I'm not saying we should go and attack them. I'm saying that the ability to just be like, oh, well, we're going to let people go, and it's fine that they're living that way, and to not address it is that, to me, is absurd. It's outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead, because I know you talk about this in your book.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think two things. Like, one is that you can't separate gentrification from like these larger trends in globalization and income inequality. You know, we're seeing the largest gap in income inequality in 100 years in this country. With globalization, a lot of the middle class jobs that provided people things like places to live no longer really exist. So I think that's one point. And then the other point I wanted to make is this idea of gentrification kind of turning cities into ladders, which another activist in New Orleans told me about. You know, everyone kind of gets pushed down a rung. So let's say you're rich and you're on the top of the ladder, or you're middle class or in the middle of the ladder. You know, when your rent goes up, it squeezes everyone down. And so the middle class goes down a rung, the poor go down a rung until they're living in tent cities, or they're just pushed off the map completely. And that's what I kind of focus on in the San Francisco part of the book, is what happens to people who get pushed off the ladder completely. They go to places like Concord or to Pittsburgh, or they go in the New York area, they go into remote Pennsylvania, where one of the largest Latino nonprofits in New York just opened its second branch in Reading, Pennsylvania, out of all places. So the new kind of like urban poverty you're seeing actually isn't urban at all. It's in these far-flung places where there are no services, where there's no kind of cohesive way to help poor people like there used to be in inner cities. So yeah, I mean, the answer is people are going everywhere but here.
Yeah. I want to go to a slightly more cheerful note, I guess, which is what are some of the solutions to this problem? And in your book, Peter, you have several things that people can do at the end. One of them is expand, protect, and make accessible public lands. Can you talk about that for a minute? Because that's something never would have occurred to me.
Yeah, so, I mean, and a lot of these ideas, as you were saying, are kind of pie in the sky, but they're only pie in the sky because of our current, like, dark political reality. They're not, like, you know, untenable solutions. They exist in many other countries, and a lot of them existed in this country at one point. You know, New York City still has 600,000 people living in public housing, whereas every other city has essentially abandoned public housing as a thing it does. So it's still there. The ideas are still there. They're just consistently underfunded and ignored. But yeah, expanding public lands, if you think about how much land is publicly owned in most cities, from the streetscapes to the lots that are sold off for development. I mean, in a city like San Francisco, it's in a lot of ways too late to do this because the city sold off so much land. And in New York too, but like back in the 80s, half of sections of Harlem were publicly owned because of the debt crisis. And in New Orleans after the storm, and in Detroit after its bankruptcy, huge swaths of the city were publicly owned. And instead of preserving and protecting that land or building affordable housing on it, they usually sell it off to the highest bidder. But even in a place like San Francisco, where you could easily take a poorly designed street and redo it so it has fewer lanes and set off some part of it and build a public housing complex there, that's not being done. But those are the kinds of solutions that are going to be necessary if we're going to actually address this as like huge state-sponsored activity in terms of developing public housing and taking land off the private market.
I'm just going to read the other ones, and then you and Paul can talk about your thoughts on these. One is to give people an actual say in what happens in their city, which is like in New York, they have community boards, and I think in some cities, activists have been able to make inroads into council meetings. There's that one woman you talk about who's screams at all the meetings, and heavily regulate housing, which is important. Implement a new deal based on FDR's New Deal housing program, and protectionism, add infrastructure, raise taxes, raise wages, spend on the poor. And I think that's probably the most difficult, certainly in this environment. We're not raising taxes and we're not raising wages. I mean, we are in some states like California and some counties like Los Angeles, but and spending on the poor. So these, when I said to you earlier when we were talking in the green room about this panel, and I said, these are wonderful thoughts, but how realistic are they? And I mean, maybe both of you can talk about these as possible solutions, and if you can think of any more, what people can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is a silver lining of Trump being president, it's that people are willing to think outside of the box and just saying, fuck it, liberalism, this like kind of banal liberalism that doesn't really get us anywhere, but that has a nice shine to it, which I would consider like the government of San Francisco to like embody that. people are saying like, well, obviously that's not working. Let's do something more extreme. So I do think that these ideas are quote unquote out there, but they're not impossible. If you look at Berlin, where there's essentially universal rent control, even if you look at New York, where a large portion of the buildings are still under rent control and rent regulation, that was done in the 1960s, and I think San Francisco's was as well. What was the political climate then that allowed that for that to happen, and why do we consider that pie in the sky now? So I think it's really just a question of political will. I guess I shouldn't go too far into this, but I think a huge failure of the Democratic Party and of liberals in general is to address these class-based issues. Mm-hmm. They've kind of become a social party, which is all well and good. They care about social issues, but when it comes to economic issues like housing, housing wasn't mentioned once in the Democratic platform. Hillary Clinton didn't mention it once. Bernie Sanders didn't mention it once. Housing is our number one expense from cities to suburbs to rural areas, and it wasn't mentioned once in any of the debates in any of the platforms. So if you're wondering like where to start looking, I mean like why is our theoretically progressive party not even addressing one of our number one issues?
Well, I think that's an excellent point because I think there's a lot of powerlessness in that individuals feel. And ultimately, our leaders need to represent our desires and our wants. And so, who we're electing and who we're getting to represent us is one place to put our energy. if we don't know where else to put it. But then there's sort of what I had to ask myself is, here's this thing that's happening to me, and now suddenly it's a bigger issue. You know, whenever it's at your doorstep, you care more about it. I mean, that's just an unfortunate truth. And I had to ask myself, oh, am I going to become an activist? And I ultimately had to look in the mirror and say, no, I can't become an activist because I won't see it through. I know what my day-to-day life is like, and I think to affect any real change, you need to be committed. And we all need to ask ourselves, you know, can I be committed in that way? And if I can't be committed in that way, which way can I be? And, you know, for me, it's through drawing and writing. You know, I use a creative platform. And so that's where I can give my most energy, and then I can take an idea and deliver it to the public. And so, yeah, I almost see, like, our books, it's almost like cause and effect, right? Like, you've addressed the causes and you illuminate those for us. And my book, in a way, is like the canary screaming in the coal mine, like, hey, you're all about to suffer and suffocate down here. But that's how I can contribute best. And that's sort of what I figured out by being in those activist situations. And, you know, that it's difficult to say to yourself, oh, I don't think I can see X through. So it's really about what's the why? What's the thing that I can do? Mm-hmm. And, you know, electing, but even that, you know, I think probably a lot of us in this room feel like we were, all our efforts were let down about 6 months ago politically. So, you know, and at least the people around me after the election felt really powerless because they didn't know how to say, what can I do by the end of today to believe that I'm going to make the world I live in a better place? So, you know, maybe it's a bit of an artful response, but it's sort of like tapping into yourself and saying, well, what really do you contribute best to the world?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You want to? Oh, well, no, you go ahead.
Okay.
You're the panel.
And I do think, yeah, to get down to that individual level, I mean, not to chastise people from San Francisco too much, but there were several ballot measures, I think, last year that failed by a lot. One was a moratorium on development. One, I think, was a tax on Airbnb. They didn't even come close to passing. So I would say that people in San Francisco, a lot of them, and a lot of people all over are living in this kind of gentrified mindset. It is about an individual mindset in a way. Sarah Schulman, the writer, talks about the gentrified mind, how we kind of create these gated communities in our mind when we move to cities, you know, and that manifests itself in the kind of architecture we build. You see these skyscrapers with gyms and pools in them. You know, you use Seamless or Grubhub or whatever to get your delivery. You don't know who your neighbors are, and you essentially stay in this gated community in the sky. So I think it does really start with a change in mindset of, are we seeing ourselves as consumers of cities, or are we seeing ourselves as a larger community that can affect change?
It struck me when I read that about Airbnb, and it was so overwhelmingly in San Francisco, of all places, where this is such an issue, and where so many people, activists, vote, and then you see this happen, and I it occurred to me that a lot of people, I read a story about a lot of people in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles can only hold on to their houses if they rent out rooms through Airbnb. I mean, I have a brother in Portland, and he rents out a room in his house for Airbnb just to help make the monthly payments. And, you know, so you might have gotten a lot of votes from those kinds of people who saw this revenue stream possibly drying up. So there's so many sides to this. We're going to go to questions. So, and I'll try to call on everybody. So you first. Oh, wait, 1 second, wait. 1 second, please.
We're podcasting this, so we're going to have a mic that we're taking around for our questions. So that
makes me turn on the mic. Yeah. And while she's getting the mic ready,
test.
We want questions only and no statements or speeches, please.
Actually, and I want to say one last
thing. Yeah, wait, 1 second.
Before, about the Airbnb, I think there's a lot of us are caught in the middle because how many in this room have not used Airbnb somewhere else? You know,
yeah.
Or, you know, how many, we have these things that are basically helping gentrification that also, you know, help our lives. Every one of us in this room probably has a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
That is a part of technology. That's part of everything we're talking about. So, you know, that sort of personal culpability is difficult to wrestle with.
Okay, you may go.
I wanted to ask.
We can't hear you, though.
People on the panel, if this is not the youngest age group you have seen in any of these forums, it is for me. Everyone here is in a different age group from me. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. Somebody did comment yesterday on one of the panels that the audience seems so elderly, and I think that meant anyone over 50. I'm not sure. I'm way beyond that, but yes, it is young because this is an issue that really hits young people. Yes.
Hi. My question is about foreign investment in real estate. I've heard that the oligarchs are actually investing in real estate and leaving buildings empty because all they want is a place to park their money.
Yeah, he has a... Peter writes about this a bit.
So if we could go back to like that latter metaphor, I think that's a big part of it, especially in cities like San Francisco and New York. In a section of Midtown, which is starting to be called Billionaires Row, there's a section of that part of the city where most apartments are vacant over 50% of the time, like the majority of apartments. So it's essentially people parking their cash from Russia, from China, from other developing economies in those buildings. This goes back to what I'd call real estate capitalism. We're not actually like buying things anymore as much as we're buying instruments to grow the wealth that already exists. So there's nothing to really invest in besides empty spaces at this point. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on global cities where foreigners come. It's not only foreign investment, it's, investment within the U.S. too. From the tech industry in San Francisco, from any driver of the economy that creates vast amounts of wealth, there needs to be a place to park that wealth now, and housing is one of the only places left.
Back there with the hat.
Hello.
Hello.
I would like to know, so you just were talking about the kind of using the property as a commodity and as an investment. What reverses that? What decommodifies it? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I don't know if it has an easy answer. I mean, from the governmental side of things, I think it surprises most people when I tell them this. Hong Kong, for example, which no one would consider like a communist place or an anti-capitalist place, 50% of all new housing that's built gets funded by the government and set aside for low-income residents. 50%. In many advanced economies where inequality is rampant, there's also a recognition that needs to be addressed if an economy is going to function at all. So I don't think you have to necessarily be anti-capitalist to at least admit that you need protections for the poor and housing set aside for them. That being said, I think the kind of better solution would be to decommodify all property. I tend to lean towards the communist, maybe anarchist side of things. I think it's a much larger issue. You know, the U.S., the founding of the U.S. is based on the idea of private property that was in, our Constitution, right? So there's the idea that you can own land and grow its value is a central tenet of the United States. So I don't really know how to undo that except to, overthrow the government or something. But I think that would be a good solution. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, wait, we need the mic over. Oh, wait. Go ahead. Over here. And then we'll go back over there and over there.
I'm sorry I didn't come to the beginning here, but I'm wondering, speaking of commodification, whether the tax breaks that go with house ownership, and the last time I checked, a billionaire could own two so-called homes, and no questions asked, nobody asking whether you qualify, deduct $1.1 million at the time I checked which I calculated was about a $480,000 or $40,000 a month subsidy for Bill Gates to buy houses, no questions asked. And I said to friends, if I would go around saying, let's give the homeless a $40,000 a month subsidy, right, they would take me away in a straitjacket. So do you think that that law or those laws are adding to the problem?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that we, that rich people like exists as, you know, in a vacuum or like without subsidy or without help from the government, you know, that they somehow are more deserving of their money, to me is patently false because of things like this. Like, the, you know, one of the largest subsidies that our government provides is to mortgage holders. And you can deduct that from your taxes no matter who you are. But yeah, it goes up with the value of your house. And as I said back towards the beginning of this conversation, you know, the entire creation of the suburbs was a purposeful way to give white people housing wealth. Like, it was written on paper, this is our intent, to give white people housing wealth, to create a middle class made out of white people who were living in poverty during the Great Depression. So I think you see that all over the place. You see these huge subsidies, even in San Francisco, you know, people, the government keeps giving subsidies to tech companies to move in, even though they really don't need them. It just all goes back to this growth mindset that the more wealth you grow, the better for everyone. And until that changes, I don't think, you know, yeah, Ed, sorry, I can't keep talking about San Francisco's government. But Ed Lee keeps getting reelected for some reason.
I would just add one thing. In Peter's book, he reminds us that the top tax rate in the 50s and 60s for the richest Americans was 91%. And until 1981, it was 70%. Today, it's about 40, but it's going down because if the tax decreases that Trump wants go through, it'll be less. And that's all money that, I mean, you can't implement a new deal if you don't have the tax money to do it. And if you don't have the tax money because, you know, you're not collecting as much, it's going to be all the more difficult. And when you're increasing your defense budget by billions and billions, and it's just so out of whack. So that's why these solutions, I mean, and like Peter said, when homelessness and housing are not even on the agenda of either party, first of all, it explains why Trump was elected in large part, and, you know, where do we go from here? So it does take people, I think, activists, local activists. If you start at the local level and you move up, I think your chances are greater to accomplish something. So just like the people in Boyle Heights were able to shut down this art gallery and kind of try to forestall gentrification of that particular neighborhood, then, you know, that's how you get things done. So there was somebody back there.
That's loud. In the Bay Area, we're seeing a growth of the YIMBY movement, or the Yes in My Backyard movement, which is ostensibly about making housing more affordable, but seems to me to be more about deregulating development. And I was just wondering if you've come across it in your work and what you think about it and how you see it related or not to gentrification.
Right. And if you want to,
please.
This is probably one area where I'm like a little more conservative than people probably think I am. American cities are really not dense, and that's a problem. I don't think that means you just develop. You should have a development free-for-all. Definitely not. But it is a problem that, you know, especially in Oakland, in LA, and Detroit, you have these sprawling cities that are completely based on cars, and you can't really begin to address issues like affordable housing if you don't have a cohesive streetscape, for example. That being said, the only way developers develop without government interference is for the richest. It doesn't make sense economically to develop for poor people unless you have government subsidy. So if you want to see an example of what Yes in My Backyard does, you can go to Bushwick in Brooklyn, where they've built tens of thousands of units of luxury housing over the last few years. And Developers are even saying, all right, we can't build anymore. It's too much. They're not renting. But what that's done is create a 2% price decrease in the neighborhood over the last year. 2% after, you know, decades of doublings of rent. So that's what you get with Yes in My Backyard, is an overabundance of apartments that only make sense to economically on a luxury development model. That it doesn't actually, housing doesn't trickle down like that. Developers rather keep those properties vacant or offer, you know, a month concession to move in or something like that than start renting them out to poor people. And when you're looking at, you know, a rent-controlled unit in Bushwick is about $500, $600, $700, something like that. These apartments are renting for $3,000 a month. So why is a developer who built a building that's supposed to be rented for $3,000 a month say, you know what, let's rent it for $700. It wouldn't make any sense economically.
There was one, this here, and then we'll go back to you.
Mr. Moskowitz, you've identified, articulated the key dynamic of gentrification, which is turnover of residents. What distinction would you draw between eviction and displacement? And if that's a softball, I'll give you a second question to back it up. It's your call.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
What's the difference between eviction and displacement?
You've used
the words interchangeably. You and Mr. Madonna both have.
Well, yeah, I mean, eviction has like a specific legal meaning, and displacement can happen through a variety of methods. I think often we too often think of displacement as that more stringent definition, you know, like eviction-based displacement. Mm-hmm. But it happens in many ways. If you could consider me displaced from the West Village because I can't afford to live there anymore. They do a lot of surveys of gentrifying neighborhoods, academics do, and they find that evictions are relatively low, or lower than you think they might be, but they don't realize that people are just not moving there anymore or aren't moving back. You go away to college, you leave for a year, and then you just stay out. That doesn't count as eviction, but it's still displacement nonetheless.
I think the New Orleans example is a good example of displacement, right, rather than eviction.
Well, also, to your point, how many creative people are moving to, in terms of the arts, how many musicians, how many poets, how many artists are moving to the Mission District of San Francisco right now compared to, say, a decade before that, et cetera? Probably, I would guess, a significantly less amount than 20 years ago. Right. So I think that's how I would define displacement, which is something that, how can we measure other than to look at an absence?
Yeah.
You want the more prickly one?
Sure.
Displacement and eviction, whichever way you choose to call it, is grounded in the inability to make payment for what one needs. What is the process by which an individual comes to feel entitled to have someone else pay their bills for them?
I think that's,
but I'm not sure. You know, actually, I'm going to take that question and go in a different direction, actually. I'm going to launch off that, which is, this is playing off the I'm the middle class white guy thing, which is that to say that I was evicted came with an enormous amount of shame. And it also put me in a very awkward position in whether it be public or personal, of oh, I thought you were successful. And also my own personal definition of success, I felt like a pretty successful guy. I mean, I'd spent, you know, 12 years being a professional artist and writer. I could travel internationally. I could make the projects I wanted to make. You know, I put a lot of the money I made back into my work, which is why, even though I have a savings account, I didn't have $1.3 million to pay cash for a home. And that shame of having to tell my friends, oh, I'm losing my place, because in anywhere else other than these major cities, to be evicted is essentially like, I didn't pay my bills for a year, there are goats in my house. Mm. And like you said, that, and it's you've clearly screwed up your life. But in a place like San Francisco, which you there's a great line in your book where you say, San Francisco has the highest, pardon me if I'm going to butcher it, it has the highest in favor rules for renters, And so it only shows how valuable the real estate is, that of how high the eviction rates have gone. And so for this to happen to somebody who has a good income and is still within that successful realm, how do you deal with the shame of it? And I think that that's... That was an enormous, it's still an issue for me. I'm out here, you know, talking about a book. I'm, instead of saying like, oh, celebrate my fourth book with me, I'm saying, oh, I lost my home. You know, these are difficult things to, how do you reconcile those two? They seemingly don't line up.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of who deserves what, I mean, what does a developer contribute to a city besides more glass? Like, I don't see, you know, there's value people produce by living in a place. And I don't think just because you have more money that gives you higher value. I would say most of the time it actually lessens the value of a city. If you go to these neighborhoods that have been highly developed, like go hang out there. They suck. Like, they're bad neighborhoods. And so, you know, like that, yeah, I mean, money doesn't equal good. It shouldn't give you more of a right to anything, in my opinion.
Yes.
Hi. From 2007 to 2011, I co-founded a nonprofit which advocated for indigent homeowners in West Oakland. And I did that via funding from my work study program in college. So time went by, we lost our funding and weren't able to obtain grants to continue that. We helped 4 homeowners remove blight and renovate their properties. My question is, do you have any resources or ideas for funding for nonprofits that are advocating for low-income housing?
I unfortunately do not.
Any ideas of creative funding?
I mean, the most successful kind of organizations I've seen are land banking organizations, just because they, and if you don't know, it's essentially people getting together and pooling money and buying housings and taking it kind of off the market and keeping it permanently affordable. Those to me are the most inspiring because they don't rely on traditional nonprofits and traditional government structures for funding, which, you know, tend to be really finicky and at the whims of whatever politician happens to be running them. Mm-hmm. So I think the more grassroots you can go, the better, but that's the only advice I have, really.
So I just want to say that as an author, I know that the one thing you really want more than anything is for people to buy your books. And we have books for sale for this panel. We have to end it now. The books are going to be sold in the gallery, the east side of the lobby on the main floor. I want to thank and wish very good luck to both of our authors. This is Peter's first book. It is Paul's fourth book, but he has this novel coming out, so please keep your eye on these guys and help support them. And I think I have a great idea for Peter's follow-up book, which is to go, really, I'm serious, go around the world and write about these places like Hong Kong and Germany and France, what they do in these other countries to house their homeless people and house their low-income people. I think it's a good book.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.